I'm not sitting here patiently waiting for somebody to invite me. I'm sitting here patiently waiting for something to arise in my mind. I mean, it's still early days of the retreat. This is our fourth day of the retreat, third full day. Hopefully people are settling down, kind of over the hump of the beginning of retreat. You know, it takes a while to settle. It's just inevitable. And that's whether you come from out in the world or come from the monastery. You know, we were talking and saying how that, yeah, first day, I was really tired. That you don't recognize sometimes until you really, really stop. And that's, of course, that's the benefit of actually stopping, taking periods of time for retreat. You get to see what the mind, you know, what it's been up to. Sometimes it's it's not a pretty picture. But there you are, and it's what we have to work with. But it's also one of the reasons why it's really helpful to be clarifying meditation object, because by taking meditation object such as the breath or whatever meditation object one is familiar and comfortable with, but by taking the meditation object and developing attention on it, sustaining attention, and being able to for the mind to begin to stay with that meditation object, then one starts to get a glimpse or get a better picture of what the mind is doing. It's kind of like if you look straight up at the sky and you can't really tell. You get a sense of maybe there's, you know, the clouds are there, they're moving a bit, but it's not really distinct. And to really get a sense of how fast are the clouds moving? What direction are they moving in? You want to be able to find a point, a juxtaposition of the sky and a point, say like a tree or a hydropole or the side of a building or something. And then you can start to get a much clearer sense of how what direction the clouds are moving, how fast those clouds are moving. And it's similar with the mind. By having that clarifying and sustaining attention on our meditation object, then we're able to start seeing more clearly, where is the mind moving? How fast is it going? I thought it wasn't moving very fast at all. Oh, look at that. So we get a much better sense, because our ordinary minds, as a Gajahn Cha says, don't trust your mind. It's a liar and a cheat. It's really like that. We'll come up with all sorts of justifications and excuses for the most ridiculous sort of movement toward our defilements. Meditation object is so important. You know, and it's not, it's not the goal to be able to hold the meditation object absolutely fixed and fixed attention, one point of attention at all times. But it's a helpful tool, it's a helpful mirror in order to get a perspective on the mind, on the nature of mind. So that picking up that mindfulness of breathing, using that sensation of the breath as an anchor, clarifying the experience with reference to the experience of the body, of feeling, of mind, of mental qualities, but in reference to breath as it comes in, the breath as it goes out, making it increasingly clear, stable, solid. And that's how we start to understand the mind. It's not by sort of analyzing it intellectually, it's by through direct seeing. The settling of the mind, the stilling of the mind, the quieting of the mind is actually what gives strength to the mind. So Gajahn Cha, I remember him saying a long, long time ago, you know, the body and the mind are different. In order for your body to be strong, you've got to exercise it, you've got to do some work, you've got to move, you've got to be active, and that's how you gain strength of the body. In order for the mind to be strong, you've got to learn how to still it. You have to learn how to quiet it. So that learning how to settle and still the mind with awareness, with a clear attention, mindfulness, and mindfulness, in a sense. You know, we do so much of everything with just half a mind, so that bringing our full mind to what we're doing. And of course, you're paying attention to what gets in the way. The Buddha, when he speaks about the developing of the, you know, sort of stable states of mind, he uses an idiom of the vi vi che wa ka me hi vi vi cha akusale hi dhamme hi, and it's, say, being secluded from sensual desire and secluded from unwholesome mental states, or being withdrawn from sensual desire, sensuality, withdrawn from unwholesome states. And that's a reference to, or what is extrapolated with, of the five hindrances, being able to withdraw from and seclude the heart from that pull to sensuality, gratification of sensual desire, ill will, aversion, being able to withdraw from that. You know what it's like when, just using that word withdraw is a really helpful image, in the sense of, you know, you get upset or angry at something, and, you know, the mind doesn't withdraw, it goes right to it and sort of stirs it up even more, fans the fires of self-righteousness. It's how anger works. So then being able to, you know, to consciously withdraw, sloth and torpor, withdrawing and secluding the heart from sloth and torpor. That's countered by application of effort, application of interest. You know, one of the misconceptions that we form in our mind is that if we just keep doing it enough, then the mind will somehow become bright and still and peaceful. But if we keep doing it with a mind that's dull or kind of lackadaisical, slothful, torporous, those are great words. I mean, it really depicts how the mind can be in the meditation sometimes, just torporous, like a treacle-laden mind, you know, swimming through the murk of consciousness, and being able to withdraw from that. It takes quite a lot of effort, really, and very conscious application of the mind to an object that is capable of brightening the mind, of clarifying the mind. And the fourth hindrance of restlessness and worry, an agitation of the mind. You know, it worries that we forgot something. It worries that we haven't got it right. It worries that, what's it going to be like in the future? It's restlessly chewing over, something that is really unnecessary for our well-being and existence in the present moment, but that's that restlessly going back to the past, worrying about the future. So these are, they're ordinary tendencies of the mind, but they're what the Buddha calls nirvana. They're hindrances, they're obstacles. They're obstacles to awareness and discernment. Learning how to relinquish them, how to withdraw and be secluded from them. It might not mean that one has completely overcome them, cut out the just really pulled out the roots of it, but at least in this present moment, during this in-breath and this out-breath, that's just withdrawing from those qualities that they have an unskillful result to them. Skeptical doubt. And this is where it's really helpful in all of these hindrances, but particularly with skeptical doubt, the sense of, all we need to do in order to meditate and practice and follow the Buddha's way is be mindful for one in-breath and one out-breath. It's all we need to do. And just keep it simple. And for this in-breath and this out-breath, skeptical doubt, uncertainty, wavering is really not necessary or essential. It can be set aside. One can withdraw from that. One can be secluded from it. And it's just that moment by moment reminding oneself. And then again, it's in conjunction with that clarifying the meditation object and taking the meditation object and making it clear. How can I increase the definition of this sensation of the breath as it comes in, the breath as it goes out, and taking an interest in it. Without obsessing too much, in the sense, because we can make ourselves really tight with obsession, but we also need to take a real interest in it. The meditation object doesn't become clear, the mind doesn't become bright, without the mind able to apply itself to the object. And so that you're trying to find this balance, a kind of a lightness of application, but not so light that it's just floating away. To be anchored and grounded, but you don't want to be so heavy with it that you're pulling yourself down. So there's that balance that's needed. And as one of the earlier talks of that phrase of Ajahn Chah's of just right. And finding that and exploring, taking an interest in, okay, what is just right? What is an appropriate, suitable application of the mind? That quality of applying the mind, it's part of the meditation. We're using the mind. We're using thought processes in the description that the Buddha gives of the first jhana. And this first jhana, the mind is very solid, very stable, very still. This is a classic description of right concentration in conjunction with the path. That first stage of stability, of inner stability, is composed of vitakka, vichara. Vitakka is, normally it's thought, the thought process. Thought arises in the mind. Vichara is was the original translations were initial thought and sustained thought. So that's the nature of vitakka and vichara. The translations, I think, are getting a bit better, a bit more descriptive, so that, say, Ajahn Jeff uses directed thought and evaluation, and that's a very good way of describing that application of the mind, application of the thought process. The way that Ajahn Chah would use it, particularly in terms of meditation, is that vitakka is what lifts up with the thought, when lifts the object up into the mind, so that with just the thought, my breath, the in-breath, that lifts, it's lifting that up. Vitakka is what lifts up that object of attention into the mind. And then vichara is what looks at it from different angles, sustains that attention over time. And of course, then that attention wavers, and it requires vitakka to lift it up again. And then that sustained thought, evaluation, that you're working with thought, you're working with the thought processes, you're working with that ability of the mind to apply and sustain attention. When it's with a neutral object like the breath, then it takes factors of interest and motivation to be able to sort of that applying along with that in order for that thought process and the application of the mind to sustain itself. If there isn't interest, if there isn't motivation, then it's going to drift off. And that's what the Buddha calls chanda. It's normally translated as desire, but it's desire in a wholesome way. It's desire in the sense of, motivation, interest. Without it, if one is unmotivated and disinterested, then it's impossible for the mind to really settle. There has to be that kind of something, some kind of juice behind it. It's not just a dry plunking your mind on the breath and keep plunking it there, and then all of a sudden you're going to be illuminated with peace and wisdom. And then that use of vitakka, vichara, is then, you're lifting up things and evaluating in ways that are creating a sense of well-being. So again, when we're speaking of the factors of the first jhana is piti and sukha, joy, rapture, and pleasure. So those are, one, they're a natural result, but they're also something to be bringing up into the mind. Like with vitakka vichara, then associations that help the mind to experience a sense of joy or lightness or zest or exhilaration and pleasure, well-being. Those are part of the process as well. You're using that vitakka vichara. You're not trying to just push everything away, because with that pushing everything away, that usually comes from that vibhava tanha. Don't want it. Shouldn't be that way. Just keep it all away from me. Then one has some energy for that for a while, but then the mind sinks. It isn't buoyed up, and the buoying up, that's where, well-being and pleasure are important. The meditation is not really sustainable without those qualities of well-being that buoy up and brighten the mind. You can't just sort of short-circuit and go straight to complete relinquishment and sort of unwavering equanimity without the mind being able to be sustained. So that use of the thought process is really important. How do we apply thought in a way that helps to, you know, bring energy to the mind, withdraw from, be secluded from the hindrances, but then also, how do we bring up qualities that do brighten the mind? Sometimes that's where, you know, recollections, reflections of Dhamma, or imagery of, say, one has a recollection of the Buddha. And it doesn't have to be, say, discursive, but just like bringing up an image of the Buddha. The image that we have here is actually quite peaceful. I'm in the process of organizing a Buddha image for Abhayagiri, the new reception hall. And we're on its third. The Buddha's in its third incarnation now. Trying to get a peaceful, balanced image. It's being carved out of stone, so you don't have much leeway for mistakes. I'm just having that visual image that we can bring to mind of a inspiring figure, you know, material figure that reminds us of what our goal is. You know, on one level, it's all mundane and material, but it has an effect on the mind when it's used skillfully. You're saying, you know, that's why we're learning how to use thought, learning how to direct thought skillfully, learning how to evaluate skillfully, so that one is encouraging and nurturing one's practice. Bringing up an object of meditation or reflection meditation, the metta, loving kindness, these thoughts of goodwill, thoughts of well-wishing, and bringing that up into the mind. There's, of course, similar with the other Brahma-viharas, but there's actually a discourse where the Buddha ties in, you know, the four foundations of mindfulness with concentration and the development of the jhanas. Because sometimes people sort of think, well, there's mindfulness practice and then there's concentration practice, and you don't want to get too caught up in concentration practice because mindfulness is where it's at. But the Buddha really didn't make a distinction in terms of very separate kind of paths. They work together. In that particular discourse, and the Buddha does, he begins with the cultivation of, you know, a monk comes and asks for, oh, it's interesting, the monk comes and asks for advice for going off into seclusion. Buddha gives him a bad time. You know, why should I, you know, basically, why should I give you instruction when you never listened to me before anyway? And then the monks are, I'm really serious this time. And then the Buddha goes on and immediately begins with the cultivation of metta bhavana, with, you know, development of meditation on loving kindness. But it's not in the usual way that it's written, because he goes immediately into developing the loving kindness meditation with vitakka, with vichara, you know, vitakka without vichara, with rapture, without rapture, with, it goes the whole, and of course then culminating in equanimity. So basically sort of going through the four jhanas, because he does the same with the other Brahma-viharas. But then the Buddha goes into he does the same, exactly the same thing with the four foundations of mindfulness, that one takes in the classical description, okay, you taking the body as a body and then developing, say, ardent, alert, mindful, turning back from the greed and distress toward the world, but then cultivating it with vitaka vichara, with all the different permutations, with rapture, with pleasure, with equanimity, clarifying and settling the mind with these four foundations of mindfulness, but using that as a basis for for concentration, for the firm establishing of the mind, that quality of samadhi, because it's that stillness and stability of the mind that allows one to really see clearly. Because we're not trying to conjure up clever analyses of the way things are. The way things are is as it is. And we have to be still enough and clear enough to see it, to realize it, to recognize it. Because the nature of the mind, the habit of the mind is just, the way things are, poof, what else is there? so that to be, this is the true nature of things. And then the heart really opens. So that quality of stillness and stability is really essential. And of course it's built on that working with the meditation object. It's built on working with the mind in relation to the meditation object. It's built on the integration of these different qualities, using those different qualities of the first jhana as an example. That is, vitakka, vijara, piti, sukha, ekakata, directed thought, evaluation, rapture, pleasure, unification of mind. These are working together. But then they're also applied. In the Buddha's instruction, it's like using those qualities that start to work together, clarifying the meditation object, the mind settling, hindrances dropping away, these wholesome qualities arising, but then also bringing it back and internalizing it again, so that the Buddha, saying, one takes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, born of withdrawal, and one takes it back and brings it into the body as it drenches, fills, steeps and pervades this body. So it's really, one is very consciously, applying the mind, but then also bringing it back into the nourishing and nurturing this system. And again, it's embodied, and the Buddha is very specific in those, actually in all of the jhanas, where those four jhanas, taking that refined sense of well-being and permeates and pervades, steeps and fills this very body with that well-being, that pleasure, and then it gets, as the mind continues to settle, there's a dropping of away of the more exuberant aspects of well-being, and increasingly still and clear. It's possible. But it's brought back into the body. And one's working with it. And it's like the image that the Buddha gives of for the first jhana, the bathman or the bathman's apprentice, taking bath powder and then mixing it with water, and you put too much water in, it just sort of ploop, it's all over the floor. If it's not enough, then it's, you know, it's still powdery. One has to mix it. And maybe a better image is maybe like, so like making bread or something, where one takes flour and then mixes it with water. And then there's some work that goes into it, kneading it, moving it, shaping it, kneading it again, so that it's thoroughly mixed. I mean, you don't just sort of, you get a bowl and pour the water in and put it into the oven. I mean, it's just it'd be a mess. Having the ingredients is one thing, and then getting the mixture right, it takes it to another level. And that's, in terms of meditation practice, we really have all the ingredients. We have them already. It's just learning how to get that balance. It's learning how to get that, learning how to work with it, to mix it, to tune it, to be attentive to it, to care for it. It's a skill that we learn, we work with, we struggle with. But that's how we find that quality, say, of just right, is through the experimenting. And then similarly, in the same way that the meditation is not just to make the meditation object clear, it's to nourish and nurture the heart, nurture the mind, settle it. But then, that has a purpose as well. That has a goal. And that comes in the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, when the Buddha kind of lays out the practice. And there's a refrain at the end of each section. One has applied that ardent, alert, mindful, turning back from the greed and distress toward the world. But then, it's directed to being attentive to the body externally, internally, externally, internally. So then there's that, one's learning about, okay, how's this work? How's this happen? What does it do when the mind goes out? What's it like when it's in? How do we apply it in relevant ways and relevant situations? And then that is, you're learning about how to direct attention. Then there's you're bringing it in a bit more, and the Buddha said, and paying attention to the aspects of arising, the aspects of ceasing, the aspects of both arising and ceasing. How do these different qualities come to be? How do they cease? Which ones are worthy of attending to arising? Which ones are worthy of attending to their ceasing? Again, you're paying attention to causal processes, and it's one of the central features of the Buddha's teaching, is that all things arise from a cause. They cease because of a cessation of that cause. That's actually it's a paraphrase, but there's a verse of Asaji, one of the first five disciples, meets Sariputta in the village, and Sariputta is impressed by his demeanor and asks him for a teaching. And Venerable Asaji sort of said, I'm just newly ordained, I'm not really capable of teaching. He's actually already an arhat. And then Sariputta presses him and says, what does your teacher teach? And that's how Venerable Asaji gave a very short summary of the Buddha's teaching. And it's around those causal principles. And that was enough. When Sariputta heard that was enough for him to realize stream entry. And then it's that verse ended up being enshrined and used in ancient India, all over Buddhist holy sites and shrines and stupas. And it's carved in stone all over the place. So that sort of that recognition of that central place of causal processes. So that our, say, development of these four foundations of mindfulness, taking into account these investigation of arising and ceasing, but then paying attention to their, well, what's behind it? What are the causes? What are the conditions? In Buddhism, when you're thinking in terms of causal processes, you're not thinking in a linear sense of cause, one effect. What you're looking at is causes and conditions, the causes and the surrounding conditions that are part of the process for the arising and ceasing. So that it's a bit more nuanced, and because of that, it needs a more clear attention. But then there's also, in terms of this process of cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha goes on to say, or one has, and this is in relation to just the first foundation of mindfulness, and the same for all the rest of them. There is enough mindfulness that there is a body. There is this body, and for clear awareness and knowledge. And one dwells independent, not clinging to anything in the world. And it's sort of a culmination and the fruit of the practice. And, you know, it's important to realize that fruit, we have to put the causes in. But it's also important to realize, well, what the fruit actually is. It's like the quote I made sure we included in the island of Yogi Berra. You want to know where you're going, otherwise you might wind up somewhere else. this is where it's going, is to an abiding of a real simplicity. And the word that the Buddha uses in Pali, atamayata, and it's literally, it's sort of not made of that. It's usually translated as, it depends on the translator. Say like Bhikkhu Bodhi and Venerable Nyanamoli translated as non-identification, which is more of with an object in mind. Or Sajjan Jeff translates it as non-fashioning, which is more of a subjective. Or Ajahn Buddhadasa translates it as unconcoctability, which is an interesting use of English. But it's subjective, and the mind is not concocting the complications and proliferations that are so much a part of what we're used to. Yeah, we're not used to experiencing the body and so, oh, there is a body. It doesn't take very long, just the stories start rolling out. So that being able to say, oh yeah, there's this possibility. And in our practice, it's helpful to, you know, to lift that up as a possibility for the mind to incline towards. In the same way that, yeah, our meditation might not be all that great, but we can be lifting up the possibility of, yeah, vitaka, vichara, bhiti, sukha, kakata. We can incline. When we hold it up as a possibility, then we incline towards it. Whereas if we hold up, yeah, we hold up the five hindrances as our possibility and our summation of all our possibilities, then it's a very different result. So to be... It's that lifting up, and that's that function of vitaka vichara again, directing of attention directing of the thought processes, the workings of the mind. Yeah, the Buddha is pointing to things that we all have, we can all experience. And the truth that he's pointing to is not, yeah, it's not beyond anybody's capability. So we can work with that.